Okay, so this is, let me test my pointer. Yes, that works. So this is cycle counting the next generation. Now, many of you, I think, have young children. You probably know H.A. Rey, who wrote Curious George. But the other thing that he's known for is that he came up with a new set of geometric graphs to use as mnemonics for knowing the constellations in the sky. This is the one for Leo, okay? And you see it looks sort of like a lion. And the previous ones were much less representational. So that's the other thing H.A. Rey is known for. He wrote a famous book in the 1950s that I think was called The Constellations and How to Learn Them or something like that. Okay, so here's an outline of what I'm going to talk about. Some of this will be familiar if you were around for my talk last year. I'm going to start with just the idea of cycle counting, and then I'm going to introduce this piece of software that I wrote called Etchy, and I'll talk about Knight's tours and equivalent circuits and the next generation, how I'm thinking of expanding or making this work better with large graphs. So here's the basic concept, okay? This definition is actually a little confusing because it's necessary to really be specific about it. But you start with a labeled graph, and the question is how many subgraphs can you find in it that are cycles, okay? And the decision version of this is are there at least k number. So here we have k4, and there are 7 cycles in it, okay? There's the 3 faces, 1, 2, 3, and then you go around the outside, that's 4. And then you can also do 1, 2, 3, 4, and back. That's a Hamiltonian cycle, and there are 3 of those, because you can go in from any of the 3 sides. Total of 7. And in fact, for that particular graph, it's easy to prove that it can't be any more than 7 using a cycle basis, because a cycle basis will have 3 elements in it, and then all zeros is not counted, so it's 2 to the 3 minus 1. Now, something that's sort of interesting about this counting cycles problem, it's sharp P complete, okay? So it's equivalent to counting certificates for an NP hard problem, even though the decision form of the thing you're counting is there a cycle? That's not NP hard, okay? So, you know, you could say we'll count Hamiltonian cycles. That's the same complexity class. Okay, they're both sharp P complete. Trying to come up with some applications. This is a very theoretical kind of a thing, but you can say that it has some applicability to reliability. Because whenever you've got a cycle, that means for 2 points on the cycle, you've got 2 independent paths between them. So if you have any kind of a concept of I want to be able to talk to my destination in 2 different ways, then the ability to do that is related to reliability. And so the number of cycles in a graph, on the one hand, if there are a lot of cycles, that means that then you have a lot of these kinds of double connections. And on the other hand, it means that you have a pretty good chance of breaking a lot of cycles if you lose an edge. You can also ask some questions, and this is actually the direction in which I started looking at this, and I've got ongoing work with Steph and Ben about extremal graphs, the graphs that have the most cycles up to certain parameters. Cycle counting is also kind of neat because it's sort of a prototype of a sharp P complete graph problem. Some of the things that we learn about cycle counting are, or I can hope, are also applicable to other kinds of sharp p-complete problems. And finally, I mean, here we have someone who really likes combinatorics for its own sake. Some people really just like to count things. So here's the most obvious thing you might think of if you want to count the cycles in a graph. Okay, backtracking. You just do a depth-first search, and when you detect a cycle, you backtrack. You have to do a little bit of extra thinking to make sure you don't overcount a cycle or that you don't miss any starting points, but it's not really hard to do this. And if you run the backtracking to the end, you're guaranteed to see every cycle once. And that's pretty much optimal if you want a list of the cycles. If you want to actually know what all of the cycles are, then you do your backtracking, and that works pretty well. But the problem is that you have to do at least a constant amount of work for every cycle that gets counted. Okay? And that doesn't sound very bad, but there's really a lot of cycles. Okay? And that could take you much more time than you can afford. How many cycles are there? Okay? Lots. By lots, what I really mean is it's something kind of like n factorial. Okay? I mean kind of like in a very vague way. It's not even like big O of n factorial or omega of n factorial. I mean it's something like, well, it's within an exponential factor of n factorial. This expression here, n factorial times c to the minus n, what that really means is I'm dividing by some exponential. And factorial is so big that when you divide it by some exponential, it doesn't even make much difference. It's still really big. Okay? So what that means is that you can't afford to do something once for every cycle. Once your graphs get to be of any realistic size, the number of cycles is just far too big. Incidentally, you also have to, when you're implementing it, use big nums and arbitrary precision integers and so on. So what can we do? Well, let's try to look at the graph and prove things about it. Here's a simple induction that we might apply. Okay, I say I'll choose an edge, and I can say easily enough, every cycle must either pass through the edge or not. So I'll just then count those possibilities. I'll take the graph minus my edge and count cycles in that. And I'll take the graph and require that edge to be in it, in which case what's left of my cycle is a path through from U to V. So I've just got some fairly clear notation here for I count paths from U to V in the graph minus that edge, and I count cycles in the graph minus that edge. And so if I just solve those recursively, then I've got my answer. And for the path subproblem, you can do a similar kind of an induction. But really, that's just backtracking in disguise. Okay, this is, if you solve this recursively, you end up with basically the same thing that you would get by backtracking. So here's a different inductive step that seems like it's more powerful. Okay. Back on the previous slide, I had cycle problems and path problems, but nearly all the ones I actually look at when I do the induction are path problems. So if I'm solving a path problem, I want a path from U to V, and there happens to be a cut vertex W in between. All right? I can build that path by finding one path through the chunk before W and one path through the chunk after W, and those are independent. So I count the ones on this side, and I count the ones on that side, and I multiply them. Okay? And that's nice because the work I do is this plus this, and the count I get is this times this. So that seems like it's a way to get to larger numbers without having to spend constant time on them. Here's something I can do that's the same sort of thing. I mean, it would be nice if I can find a cut vertex on my path, but that's pretty rare. So maybe I can find a two-vertex cut, all right? In that case, it splits into a bunch of cases, but only like six or seven of them. So I can say, well, I could have a path that goes from U to W1 and then back through here through to W2, or it could go straight through and not come back to W2 at all. I can find all those cases, and I can count them as subproblems that are still the same type of subproblem. They're find a path through this graph chunk. And then I add and subtract a few of those, and I get a count for the whole collection. So that provides an outline for a piece of software that one could, and I did, write. Okay, I call it the enhanced cycle counter and Hamiltonian integrator. We will canonically label the subproblems, and the point of that is to get rid of symmetry. If I happen to have two different subproblems that are actually isomorphic and will have the same count, if I canonically label each of them, then I can store the results of each one I solve in a hash table. And then if I ever see that same one again, I look it up instead of counting again. So the hope is that this way I can take advantage of any symmetry that exists in the problem. Okay? And it's kind of nice that I don't even have to remember them all, because there may be billions in a calculation. I can just store as many as I have space for. And what I actually do is, when I have a hash collision, I just overwrite the previous one. Because if I forget one, that just means I have to recalculate it. I don't lose any correctness there, only a little time. So I implemented that, and I spent a fair bit of time tweaking it. I made it do multi-threading, so I can run it on a multi-core computer, and it will take advantage of all the cores at once. They all share the hash table, and they do the appropriate serialization so that they don't stomp on each other's results. And I've been applying that to the extremal graph theory questions with Steph and with Ben. Basically, what we've been looking at is if you take all the graphs with up to n vertices and a fixed girth, which ones have the most cycles? Okay, so I've got answers for that. It depends. I say n approximately 15 is the limit. That depends very much on what constraints you put on it. But for reasonable size n, I can answer it just by testing them all. And something that's notable when I do this is that the cost of generating the graphs, I use the standard off-the-shelf utilities, specifically McKay's GenG program, that costs more than counting the cycles. In fact, a significant fraction of time just goes to converting the file formats because these programs are really fast in terms of generating the graphs. And then the limiting factor is just how big the graphs get. There are a very large number of them once n gets to any reasonable size. So the point here is that even if I could increase the speed of the cycle count by a lot, it wouldn't make much difference to the limits on what questions I can answer with this approach. When I'm just looking at every single graph, I'm limited by the number of graphs more than by the cost of the cycle count. But there are a lot of interesting questions you can also ask about counts of cycles in larger graphs, where instead of having a huge number of small graphs, you've got just a few big ones. And then the cost of cycle counting becomes much more significant, and it eventually becomes the determining factor for what questions you can answer. Here's one such question, okay? This is a classic chess puzzle, and as a puzzle, the question is simply, can you, by hand computation, find a path or memorize one, okay? We have this, the chess knight can move, two squares in one direction and one square in an orthogonal direction, so you get this particular kind of relationship between two cells. And then can you move the knight with 64 moves to hit every square on the chessboard once? It's the Hamiltonian cycle question. And the counting version is how many distinct such Hamiltonian cycles are there on the 64-square chessboard? Now, McKay, again, has found an answer to this, okay? And the way he did it was to have a human himself think really hard about it and then break it into chunks that are small enough for the computer, okay? So if you draw a line horizontally across the middle of the chessboard, you get this 4x8 chunk, and you have a relatively small number of edges that cross that dividing line. These 16 squares along up are the interface, okay? Anything going from one side to the other has to pass through those. So you take all of the partial tours that cover this half of the board and have some pattern, they create some pattern of connections among these. You don't really care about what happens down here, okay? And by backtracking, you can generate all of those half tours, okay? This number here, 70 million, that's not a terribly huge number. And it's associated with an even smaller number, about 8 million, which is the number of distinct patterns of this connects to this, and this connects to that, and this one is standalone, and so on. It's made a little bit easier by the fact that it's Hamiltonian, so you don't have to deal with the question of some of the cells might not be used. Then you have to somehow stitch these counts together. You get this database of here are all of the half tours. Which half tours could link to this one to create an overall tour that's exactly one cycle? Because if you just take two of these, you'll end up with a bunch of disconnected cycles, usually. But what that means is that it's fairly sparse. Each one only connects to a few other ones. And so in 1997, it required a fair bit of computer power, but it's still well within the range of what you can do. But if we're interested in, for instance, well, it's provably impossible on the 9x9 board, but if you want the 10x10 board by parity, if you want the 10 by 10 board or even the 8 by 9 board or something, it's not clear how you could extend this in a way that would really work. Here's another question, which is, in fact, one of the starting points. How many cycles in a hypercube? Okay. Isn't there a nice recurrence for it? It feels like there ought to be. But the trouble is there isn't, because you essentially need a count for every one of those patterns that goes across a cut. And there are no really nice, small, even cuts in the hypercube. You can cut between a vertex and all its neighbors, or you can cut right across the middle of it, in which case you've got an exponential number of edges going across. There aren't many other nice ways to cut it. I guess probably the nicest way that I've thought of is to cut along the Hamming weight planes in there, which I think is still ends up being exponential, but it's slightly smaller. So here are the known results. Okay, and the current version of Etchi reproduces all of these quite easily up to k equals 5. But it can't reasonably be applied to k equals 6. I tried it, and it was clear it would take many years to produce a result. Now, I don't know how many of you were here last year when I gave a similar talk. If you have really good memories, you may notice something about this slide. Do you? Okay. Here's the thing. One of the numbers on it has changed. In March of last year, I gave a talk about this same subject matter, and I had a slide very much like the previous one with a different number on it for that k equals 6. Okay, and then there's this new item, which is still a two-a-peer journal article, in which they say, well, that previous number was wrong, it's the right one. And McKay's count of night tours, okay, it was also presented as a correction to a previous count that was wrong. So, you know, there's the history with these kinds of numbers that when someone publishes one, how are we going to know that it's right? I can't sit there and look at this number of tours by hand and verify that they're all correct. So we can look at the theory behind the number and we can hope that it's right. And we can hope that the computer program, because they all involve extensive computation, that the computer program is a correct implementation of that theory. Here's some more philosophical thoughts on that. You know, really this question goes back to the four-color theorem, was when people started thinking about it a lot, that they had this proof of the four-color theorem that involved more computation than a human could practically do. And so, do we believe it? Now, Zeilberger, who is quite a character, has a number of results for which he's given his computer a pen name and lists it as a co-author. Should we accept that? Is that a legitimate academic practice? I don't know. This particular reference is a draft on his webpage. It's not really a published journal article, and I'm not sure a journal or editor would let him get away with doing that.
ACAD is his computer?
Yeah, ACAD is the computer. Yeah, right. Well, maybe that's just alphabetical, but...
But in large number computations, like digit pi, historically, yeah. Pre-modern computers,
yeah.
There are classic cases of errors
for sure.
Going wrong.
Yeah. So now, I mean, one...
Verifying is now standard.
That's right. One standard that we can apply that is starting to be sort of consensus is, well, if an independent group using a different computer and their own techniques comes up with the same number, then we can think it's quite likely that that number is right. What will I do if I do manage to count for the 6 cube and it doesn't agree with either of the two existing results? You know, how much should I believe my own results or theirs or what, you know? And you can also ask the question, well, if, now this may be, you know, this is a hypothetical sort of thing. How much does it matter whether the actual number for the hypercube is right? It seems like if there were ever a case where it would matter, then we would have a way of knowing whether it was right or not. And if there were, the hypercube probably is not in this category, but if there were a statement that we were sure we would never be able to be certain it was true or not, does it have a truth value at all?
Yes.
Okay.
Gazelle answered this question pretty well. I mean, Hilbert believed that everything that was true was provable.
Yep.
And Gazelle proved that everything that is true is not necessarily provable.
Right. There are things that are true that you can't prove.
Yeah, but the truth of it exists. It's just not provable.
Okay.
Under the axiomatic set.
All right. What about the momentum of a electron where you know its location? Do you say that that has a value that you don't know, or do you say it doesn't have a value? I don't know enough physics to argue either side convincingly, but
value.
Yeah.
You say it doesn't have a measurable value.
All right.
Yeah.
I
in this way you have to say that it doesn't have a provable.
Yeah.
Truth, whatever that means.
Yeah, and this is a little different from particle physics. This
right,
is a discrete
that's right.
Set of objects
I mean,
that
it's
is,
it's pretty easy to believe that there is only one correct answer to how many cycles exist in the hypercube.
Yeah, yeah.
But given the history of the problem, I'm going to want to see a lot of verification before I believe that the number on my previous slide actually is the right one.
You're just illustrating the fact that it's a difficult number to
obtain,
and
it's
an error.
Right, and a related fact is that if I or anybody following this kind of procedure wants to work in this, we want to be really sure that our software works.
Well, and hardware.
Yeah, and hardware, yes. But the hope is that we can hope that good software will help us verify the hardware. It's reasonable to guess that we may be able to harden the software in a way that allows it to know when the hardware is misbehaving. All right. Enough of that. I was talking about different kinds of subproblems, and to this point I've had four of them, really. There's count cycles, there's count paths, there's count Hamiltonian cycles, and there's count Hamiltonian paths. And you need to be able to count paths in order to count cycles. Here's a different way of thinking about what the subproblem is, okay? In this case, the subproblem is going to be, I have a graph, I want to count cycles, but I have some of the graphs labeled black. I want to count cycles that must include all of the black vertices. They may or may not include the white vertices. So in here, I think there are only two. Okay, you have to go around here, you have to go cover most of this face, and then you can either cut across there or go through there. And there aren't any other ways to come up with a cycle that includes both those black vertices. The nice thing about using this as the subproblem is that then you don't have to implement four of them and make sure that they're all correct, because when you had four, they had to, they could only partly share their implementations. So this, we can hope, will reduce the complexity of the implementation. And reducing complexity is important because that makes it easier to know that it's correct. We can also do a lot of things with this subproblem. For instance, we can just insert a black vertex in the middle of an edge. That forces us to use that edge as part of our cycle. And if we want to count paths instead of cycles, then we create a bridge with one of these forced edges, and then that forces, there to be a path. And if we want it to be Hamiltonian, we just make all the vertices black. And if we have a pattern like that half tour that was used in McKay's Knight's Tour thing, we can count those by building up, a cycle that would require all of the little paths that we need. Okay? There are also many new ways to think of inductive steps that we could do if we had this subproblem. Okay? For instance, we say, well, I will look at a given vertex that's white, and I will color it black. That's one new subproblem. And I will delete it. Okay? Every cycle must either contain that vertex, which is the black one, or not contain it, which is the problem with the vertex deleted. So that gives me a new subproblem. I can look at a vertex, maybe one that has a high degree, and I'll split its neighbors in half. And I'll say, well, in one subproblem, I'll color it black, and I'll only keep half the edges going out of it. In the other, I'll keep the other half. And in the third, I will split the vertex with a new edge that has a black vertex on it. So then I'm saying, well, any cycle that goes through this has to either come and go on one side, or come and go on the other side, or go right through from one side to the other. There's another subproblem. So this seems like this would be a nice way of making the code simpler. We can hope it will be more applicable. It doesn't require the existence of small cuts, such as those other inductive steps did. Here's the bad news, okay? I implemented it. This is since last time I talked about this. It doesn't really help, okay? It makes the cycle counter slower. It doesn't make it hugely slower, but it certainly doesn't improve it. One important reason, I think, and I actually thought of this as a nice way of formulating it as I was creating the slides for this talk, the new inductive steps that arise from being able to do this are all additive. It's all, we split into cases, and then the result is the sum of these two. So that doesn't really help us get away from this idea of constant time per cycle. The amount of work we do per cycle isn't reduced at all by doing that. Also, the hope was that this would be a way of getting at cases where there are cuts that are bigger than two vertices, okay? But those cuts don't actually occur and become relevant all that often. I was running some stats on how often the different heuristics are used in these calculations, and that two-vertex rule is very rarely used, although it did when I implemented it back in an earlier iteration. It did seem to help to have it. Another thing that can be observed is that many of the use of this subproblem, very often as we're going down the tree, what we're doing is we're coloring vertices black. And we're pushing it, even if it wasn't to begin with, we're pushing it towards being a Hamiltonian question instead of just being a question of counting cycles. And although I don't quite understand why yet, the cache doesn't help much at all on Hamiltonian subproblems, okay? When I am counting a non-Hamiltonian problem, I might see between 20 and 40% cache hits, which help a lot, depending on the size of the input graph. But when it's a Hamiltonian problem, the cache doesn't make much difference. It's like 1% hits. So if I am changing my subproblem in a way that causes most of my work to be done on Hamiltonian kinds of questions, then I lose some of the benefit of the cache. So, yes? I have a hash table, okay? Every time I'm looking at a subproblem, I will say, have I seen this one before? It's memoization. It's basically dynamic programming. And so I as soon as I solve the subproblem, I write it in this hash table. And then whenever I'm looking at a subproblem, I look in the hash table. Is this problem stored there? And if it is, then I use it instead of recursing. So it's fundamentally, it's dynamic programming. I'm calling it a cache rather than a dynamic programming table because I also will evict things. Okay, if I run out of space, I have a fixed size on how many I store. And then if I happen to hit a slot that's already used, then I evict the old value. Because by doing that, I don't actually lose any correctness, I just lose the time to recompute. And that is where naughty comes in, that I'm putting these subproblems into canonical form. So if I have two that are isomorphic, they'll still collide and I'll still get to see the result from my previous calculation. So the bottom line on that is that by using this more sophisticated subproblem, it may still have some advantages for implementation, but in terms of speed, it doesn't really provide an improvement for large graphs. And we didn't really need improvement for the small graphs because they are already being limited by other things that are not this cycle counter. So here's sort of another idea, okay? And I'll introduce it with this cartoon from XKCD. You know, the guy with the hat says he's got a invented a new game. Here's the mathematician crossing the street. We'll show him this sign. Okay? On the infinite grid of ideal 1-ohm resistors, what's the equivalent resistance? So the mathematician starts to think about it. I guess this one's a physicist. And is hit by a truck. It's fun. You get 2 points for physicists and 3 for mathematicians. And what I want to introduce from this slide is actually this problem. Incidentally, the answer is about 0.8. When the cartoon came out, there was a fair bit of discussion, and to really solve it, you need to use Fourier transforms and all kinds of other nonsense. I saw some really stupid answers, including infinity and zero, neither of which, you know, obviously could be anywhere. It's trivial to prove that it has to be between 0.5 and 1.5. Anyway, the takeaway lesson from though is this idea of an equivalent resistance, that you've got this infinite thing. It's kind of like just having a single resistor. So here's the deal, okay? If you've got an electronic circuit up to certain constraints, all right, you can say that its behavior is described by a linear differential equation, all right? And the nice thing about linear functions is they're closed under composition. A linear function of a linear function is still a linear function. And people do this all the time in electronics. They will have some complicated thing, and they will reduce it to a simpler equivalent circuit, okay? And there are fairly simple simplification rules for, you know, when you've got two things in parallel, you apply this calculation, it's equivalent to one thing that's just straight through, and, you know, converting the parallels here to the series there, and so forth and so on. So you can say that under the relevant constraints, a circuit of any size is equivalent to one that just has a couple of components in it. All right? So you can write a vector of constant dimension, just a few numbers, that describe all of the behavior of this circuit at the fixed frequency and under the other assumptions. When people are doing it in electronics, they usually, rather than thinking of it as a vector, they usually prefer to think of it as what does the actual circuit look like that it is equivalent to. But you can think of it as a vector. Now, you have to be kind of careful with the formulation here, and what I'm putting on the slides, I've written it in a way that will also be meaningful for the graph problem, which is not exactly the way the electronics people often write it. But I'm pretty sure that you can formulate it so that this works. You can say, well, I've got my vector that says how this one two-terminal circuit works. If I'm going to cascade another one onto the side here, this one behaves like a matrix. And then you multiply the vector by the matrix, and you get the vector for the combination circuit. And, you know, if you want to do other things with your circuits, it may become a little more complicated. And there's a trade-off in terms of which parameters you use that make some of these calculations easier and others harder. But you can typically do... Oh, no, this is the... all right, well, this is the earlier version of the slide. I am tempted, since I'm not under a time constraint, to go get the correct version because it's better. So just bear with me a moment here. You know, I went to all the trouble to figure out that what I wanted was the Kronecker product, and it's not on this slide, so I'd like to show you that bit of notation. And I'm also not sure what other... all right. So here we go. All right. The thing is, you want to be able to say that the parameters of this combined circuit are some kind of linear combination of products of parameters out of the A and B. All right. So this Kronecker product does that. It says take your two vectors, and in this case, I'm taking two row vectors, I guess, and I'm creating a new one that is like n squared number of entries that contains all the pairwise products. All right. And then you multiply that by this rectangular matrix P, which is a constant that just expresses the concept of putting things in parallel. And you're going to get a new vector that is the same number of components as these original vectors. Okay. So you can say, well, I've got these two circuits, I know their parameters, I do a bit of computation, and I get the parameters of the equivalent circuit of both of them in parallel. And it's tricky to make this work nicely with both series and parallel, but you can come up with a similar kind of calculation for putting the circuits in series or combining them in any reasonable way. And the point is that the dimension of the vectors remains constant as you go through all these calculations. All right, so we can imagine doing the same sort of thing with a graph. You know, a circuit is really just, an electronic circuit is just a graph with funny stuff added to the edges. So we can say, well, we'll just have an ordinary graph. I'll split the graph into chunks with a small interface between each chunk, all right? And within each chunk, I'll solve all the patterns of paths, okay, among the vertices of the interface. And I get a vector or a matrix or a tensor if you want something really complicated. And then I multiply these things together. I've got my constant matrix that describes what happens when I put two cuts together. And I've got a somewhat larger constant matrix for putting together two, three cuts and so on. So I've got all these chunks of graph, and I multiply together the vectors and the matrices. And I can do that recursively. Now, the vector dimension is pretty big. It's kind of like a factorial in the size of the interface. So I would really like my chunks of graph to be connected by small cuts. But that sort of expresses, and what I just outlined there, in fact, is the basis of the algorithms people have. For sharp p-complete graph problems, in general, tend to be easy, like linear time, when you've got a graph of constant tree width. Because constant tree width comes down to saying you can split it into chunks, which always have a small cut in between them. You can also do something that's sort of neat, that you can prove asymptotic bounds for the number of cycles in graphs of a given class. People have done this, for instance, with planar graphs by this kind of method with the matrices, because you compute the eigenvalue of the matrix, and that tells you what happens to the number when you concatenate a whole bunch of them. All right. So you can prove, in particular, an asymptotic lower bound on how many cycles there can be in a planar graph, and how close you can get to the actual number is determined by how big a matrix you're allowed to think about. And this is nice because it subsumes a lot of the previous approaches. Okay, when you look at those heuristics that I had from the previous or earlier version of Ecchi, they're basically doing the matrix multiplication with small interfaces. We're saying, well, I've got two chunks side by side with just one vertex or two, or a heuristic that I looked at and didn't implement, it would involve three. Okay, and it's saying, well, then I do all my smaller computations on either side, and I'm doing the matrix multiplication to combine them. And if you look at the way McKay did his Knight's Tour thing, that's the same sort of thing. Okay, this vector A in this case is describing all of those different partial tours on either side. It's a very sparse vector. If you using the formulation I came up with, the number of dimensions is something like 1.3 billion. But there's only like 7 million non-zero entries. So you compute this sparse vector, and then you multiply it by this huge matrix, which is also sparse and computed on the fly, and you get the answer. And the known results for the 6-cube, okay, are fundamentally doing the same sort of thing. Usually they use more than one level of this kind of matrix decomposition. Because the 6-cube has a fair bit of symmetry, you can split it into halves and then into quarters and eighths or whatever, and then compute patterns within the two, combine them, then combine them through a couple of levels. And this also illustrates something, which is a nice general pattern that we know about hard problems, that if you're going to put work into having an expensive heuristic, it's really valuable to do it at the top level of the computation tree. The Knight's Tour is a good example. He has this really expensive heuristic at the very top that splits the problem in half, and then just uses simple backtracking below it. Because you win so much at the top from doing the expensive heuristic. And that really is the problem with etchy, why it doesn't work on large graphs, is its heuristics are limited to things that can happen at the bottom level, okay? And then at the higher levels, it's falling back on backtracking. So that's why it seems to work well for small graphs, and you know, there's some percentage in pushing it to slightly larger heuristics of the same general type, but we really need to make the leap to splitting things at the top level in order to win. So here are some ideas on how that could actually be done. It's become apparent to me that the current sort of general software design isn't really going to be stretchable to be something that works on large graphs. Because at the moment, every heuristic has to be implemented by hand from scratch, and it's really hard to experiment with using them in different orders or different rules for exactly when I apply one, that sort of thing. That also creates a debugging mess. So it would be nice to move to more of an object-oriented design, even though I suspect that will cost a little bit in overhead on some of the simpler operations, in effect creating a toolkit for building cycle counters rather than just a single cycle counter. Doing that would also make it easier to change the subproblem definition, because these kinds of splitting operations, the subproblem that McKay was using, it wasn't count the cycles in a given chunk. It was come up with a sparse vector that describes all of the different patterns here. That's even a fair bit more general than my black and white thing. Doing this would also make it easier to choose just which heuristics to use. And that's kind of nice for verification, because it means that if I have a given problem, I can feed it through this calculation with a couple of different choices for exactly which heuristics to use. And that way I'm performing very different computations. And if I get the same result with different sets of heuristics, that gives me much better support for the idea that that result is correct. Because, you know, if just one thing goes wrong, or if one of them is implemented incorrectly, it would be surprising if using it in two totally different ways, I get the same number. And then many of the other operations that I was already thinking of, but in a sort of an ad hoc way, such as doing different things with the hash table. There are few enough graphs up to like 10 vertices that it makes sense to just pre-compute them all and store them permanently. Distributing over multiple computers, all those kinds of things can then be implemented as part of that framework. Something that's already been useful and I think is probably the right way to go, too, is to just have an extensive test suite component of this. Many of the existing pieces of graph software don't really do that, and you just have to sort of believe it because everybody uses them. But at the moment, in the current version, I've got basically all of the cycle count results that are published and known. I can reproduce and make sure that they're correct as part of my test suite. And I'm also doing coverage that I know that I'm hitting every line in the code, which doesn't prove every line is correct, but it proves that at least every line has contributed to saying that the test suite result is good. And then the ultimate is to sort of automate this meta-level issue of determining how many levels of splitting to use and where to split. Maybe that can follow from simply heuristics when the graph is over a certain size do this, but it may be that there's more needed. So those are the things I'd like to do with it in the future. And that's the end of my slides. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
So any questions? Oh, I should mention, too, that there are a few other kinds of approaches that have been used for this kind of thing. There have been some results using binary decision diagrams, which, you know, I don't know that they really make much difference compared to this kind of approach, but that exists. And also, it's relatively easy to estimate numbers of cycles. The results that I've found for that most are limited to specific classes of graphs. But there are several where there, you know, there's a fully polynomial randomized approximation scheme, and you can get within a few percent quite easily. Mm-hmm. I think it largely amounts to doing the backtracking and then estimating how long that will take.
Just a quick question. The problem that we looked at with Gerth, right?
Right.
If you're counting cycles in a graph, are you counting everything and just discarding the ones that have low Gerth, or is there something else going on?
Well, I generally use McKay's GenG program, where you can give it a Gerth and say, okay, generate graphs of this Gerth. Okay. Now, I'm not certain exactly how that works. I'm not counting for every graph, but I think that along the way when it generates them, it may also generate some that are of other Gerth and then throw those out. You know, this, I'm not certain exactly how the orderly generation program works for graphs of fixed Gerth. Actually, for Gerths up to 4, I'm running the software and telling it generate only this Gerth. For Gerths 5 and higher, no, I guess that's also true for Gerth 5. For Gerth 6 and higher, I generate them all and then throw away the ones that aren't the right Gerth. But Gerth 6 and higher are rare enough that that's not really a problem. Yeah, because as I recall, there are options on the program to forbid cycles of different sizes up to size 4. You can say generate triangle free or generate quadrangle free.
Right.
I don't think there's a generate pentagon free.
Right.
But it is true that, I mean, as Gerth gets higher, the graphs get fewer. And so that allows you to push to higher n.
As long as, well, you said the bottleneck is generating the graphs.
Yes.
Things, right? As
long, yeah,
as what's going on inside the box there.
That's right.
Generating everything.
Yeah. It doesn't generate everything, but it does do some extra work.
And then you didn't talk about how you deal with isomorphism.
Right. Well, that really comes down to invoking Naughty, right?
This particular canonical representation.
Yeah.
Is that canonical representation using a labeling of the graph?
Yes. What Naughty is a subreddit, and it's interesting that it's still basically the state of the art for this since 1981. You pass the graph, you give it a labeled graph, and then it comes back with another labeled graph that is isomorphic, such that any two isomorphic inputs give the same output. So then you can test isomorphism just by testing, do they give the same output? And it can also optionally produce the automorphism group of the graph. So that tells you about what its symmetries are like.
Presumably Naughty's been updated since then.
Oh yeah, the code has been updated, but still it's fundamentally the same algorithm. There are a few other pieces of software that do similar things. There's one called Saucy, for instance, which is basically the same algorithm again, but optimized for larger graphs. Naughty is what you want to use for smallish graphs.
Your comment about the caching.
Yeah. And the 1% for Hamiltonian.
I'm curious, is it because the Hamiltonian subproblems, what makes them so wildly different? Is it just that there's...
I don't know. I think it may be that you tend to lose the symmetry, right? A hypercube in particular is what I was most interested in. A hypercube is very symmetrical, but as soon as you start removing edges from it, the way that in which you remove the edges, you will usually tend to be asymmetric. So you tend, you know, if it's six-dimensional, the main symmetry there is that you can take the dimensions in any order. So at the very top, you cut off a factor of 120, 6 factorial. But then that's about all you gain from symmetry.
So
there probably is some...
Use this fact
Yeah, they're probably
predict whether or not there's a you've got a Hamiltonian graph or a
Hamiltonian graph.
I don't know. Now the question is this: I mean, this isn't what I'm doing here is counting Hamiltonian cycles. So I'm not saying is the graph Hamiltonian. I'm saying is my question a question about Hamiltonian cycles. And if the graph is not Hamiltonian, then I'm guaranteed to eventually get down to a case where I can prove there's no cycle in this at all. But it seems like I only do that at near the very bottom of the tree. I mean, the obvious way to prove it is if you happen to have a cut vertex and you've got a black vertex on both sides of the cut. You can't have a cycle that includes both of those because it would have to go through the cut vertex twice. So as soon as you recognize that situation, you can terminate and say the answer for this subproblem is zero. There probably is some important insight about cycles and graphs that this illustrates, but I'm not certain yet what it is.
So you said, now I'm going to be an engineer.
All right.
I'm going to ask about that infinite network.
Yes.
So is it a simple explanation for why it's between?
Yes.
Clearly, I'm going to be schmucked by a truck.
Okay. You consider the four in the neighborhood of each of the two red points, okay? Mm-hmm. So, and pretend all the others are reduced to zero.
Okay,
so you've got half an ohm between the red and the zero. You've got a quarter of an ohm between the first one and the zero plane, because that's 4 1 ohms in parallel. Mm-hmm. And then from the zero plane to the other red one, you've got another quarter of an ohm. So that's half an ohm there. And you can say it's less than it's less than 1.5, because if you start at the lower left, you go up one step and two steps over. That's 3 in a row. That's 3 ohms. And then you do it symmetrically. You've got 2 3 ohms in parallel. That's 1.5. In that case, you're setting all the others to infinity. So just from that, you can say quite easily it has to be between half an ohm and 1.5. Now,
I think we wave our hands a little, but okay.
Well,
I
if you set all of the resistors except the ones I mentioned to zero, then you know you can't possibly have increased it, right? So that. And if you set them all except the ones I mentioned to infinity, you can't possibly decrease it. Now, actually computing this exactly, as I say, someone managed to dig up a paper where it had been solved, and it uses a bunch of nasty Fourier transform stuff. An easier problem, which I can at least do in my head and is sort of interesting, is saying, what's the resistance, or is it finite, from a single point to infinity? And do that for general dimension. Or at least, is it infinity or finite?